you didn't come to hear me. But I was at a client's office this week that, well, I hope that I was on my last drunk. And this client, yesterday afternoon, I was talking to some people that wanted to come by the office to bring some information. And he overheard me say that I wouldn't be there this afternoon. And then he had just come in from South Carolina, and he said, what you got to go back to Atlanta for? I said, tomorrow afternoon we've got a special AA meeting. And so since we got up this morning, every few minutes I think he's mentioned is you're going to have time to get back to Atlanta where you can get to that meeting. But it was at this client's office that a little over, well, it would be 7 years this coming Friday, that I hope that I can say that that was my last drink. And through the help of people in AA, but I have to say that some people outside of AA also has had a hand in it, because this particular person, he and his wife, stuck by me all during that ordeal. So he said, well, one thing that he was sure of, I almost talked him into coming to this meeting, because he can really put away that booze. But you, as I said, that you didn't come to hear me talk, but we do have our good friend from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. See, I didn't learn to say that. Canada. And some of us, that's was something wrong down there? But some of us have heard Cease, and we all love him, but we're in for a treat tonight. So rather than try to tell you anything about him, I'm just going to give you CC from Prince Albert and let him tell you about himself. Cease?
My name is Cease Corrigal from Prince Albert. What did you say? Saskatchewan. And hardly say it myself. I spent so much time in the South. And I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous and very grateful to be here. I really don't know what I'm doing here, because I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be in Durham, North Carolina this weekend. And because some people decided I should be in Florida last Sunday night, and I couldn't be there because of a gratitude meeting back home, I received a notice in the mail last Monday saying that I was supposed to be here tonight. Now, I don't know whether this is the route to go to Durham, North Carolina, or I have no idea, but I just got... But I know that I received this from Wesley Parish from Florida, and I think he has... I just don't know why I'm here, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm glad that I am here. And you people that were over in Mount Eagle a few months ago, well, I don't know about you coming out again tonight to hear me, but you all say that it's pretty cold down here. I think it's a real heat wave. There was 8 feet of snow, and it was 42 below zero when I left home. So I can't understand what you're talking about when you say it's cold. But I think that I'll have to apologize to the people from around this area who were in Mount Eagle, because I'm going to practically give the same talk that I gave in Mount Eagle, because I'm just one person. If it was maybe 20 years ago, I could tell you another story, because I used to be several people at that time. But now through the help of this program, I can be only one person, and so that's the story I have to tell. Reminds me a little bit about the Jewish fellow that moved into a Catholic community. You've probably all heard the story. I moved in there, and this was the days that the Catholics had to eat fish on Friday. And every Friday, this Jewish guy used to cook a big steak right out in a barbecue. And finally, the Catholic people, they went, they formed a committee, and they went down to see him. And they said, look, you know, we have to eat fish on Friday, and you always cook these steaks. Couldn't you on Friday, couldn't you just cook something else? He said, look, I can't eat ham, you know. So he says, you people, you have to eat fish. I want to eat steak. I'll eat steak. So finally, they sent another committee down. They decided that there was only one way, that they would convert him to the Catholic Church. So the Jewish guy looked around, and he was the only Jewish guy that lived in that community, and he was in business. You know, he thought it might be good for business. So he decided to go along with it, and he took all of the instructions that they give him. Finally, the great night arrived, and they laid the little Jew down on the table, and the priest got the holy water out, and he sprinkled him, and he said, you were born a Jew, you were raised a Jew, but now you're a Catholic. He went on his way, and everything was fine till the next Friday. Lo and behold, up came the beautiful aroma of a fine steak. And not the committee, but the whole Catholic community went down to see what he was doing. And they said, you're a Catholic. What's with you? And he took out the barbecue sauce, and he sprinkled it, and he said, you were born a cow, you were raised a cow, but today you are a fish. So I guess you can be anything you want to be. I heard a terrific story just before I left home. And seeing we're in the church tonight, it's a story about four ministers, a Catholic priest, an Anglican minister, that's what we call them back home, Anglicans, I think there's something else down here, a United Church minister, and a Presbyterian minister. And they were sitting around, and they were sort of having a little talk like sometimes we have when we start telling each other what happened to us and what horrible characters we were. And finally, the Anglican minister said, you know, he said, it's too bad that we haven't got someplace we can go and discuss our defects of character. He said, everybody comes to us, but we have nobody to go to. And the Catholic priest said, you know, he said, this would be a great thing because everybody comes to me for confession. And he said, I have something, he said, that's really bothering me, and I can't find anybody that I can discuss it with. So they decided amongst the four of them that they would sort of take a fifth step right then and there. And the Catholic priest, you know, he said, I'm having a real bad time with booze. I'm drinking too much. And he said, but I feel good already that I was able to tell somebody. And before he got finished talking, the Anglican minister said, you know, I have the same problem. But the very fact that you mentioned it, he said, I feel great because now I can get it out in the open. And he said, I haven't got the knot in my stomach anymore. The United Church minister said, he said, you fellas think you got a problem, eh? He said, look, I have a problem with booze. Not only that, he says, I'm a young minister. And I have a problem with some of the people, the girls, in my community, in my parish. But he said, the very fact that I was able to discuss it with you people, I feel better. And they looked over at the Presbyterian minister and they said, what's wrong with you? Haven't you got any problems? And he said, yes, I'm a gossip. But all I can say, folks, is it's good to be here. In Atlanta, Georgia, that's where I am. I would have got dressed up, but they didn't get my luggage in here in time. Left it on Eastern Airlines, so I had to wear one of my old suits. But I'm kind of glad because Wesley just had some old clothes, and I didn't want to show him up. But it's just good to be here. And it's good to have you people come out to... And I'm not even going to try to pronounce what group it is, because I just couldn't understand it when you're chairman. It was worse than Saskatchewan, I'll tell you that, whatever the name of this group is. But as I said, my name is Cease Corrigal. I'm from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. Now, there's some more people coming. I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I celebrated my 18th year in Alcoholics Anonymous last Friday. And I hope I never forget that. The day that I came to AA 18 years ago, and that's the reason I didn't go to Pompano Beach, Florida, was because we were having a gratitude night back in my hometown on Saturday night, and I had told them that I would be the chairman. And we were having it in a prison, and I went up to tell the boys that I wasn't going to be there, but to help them set the place up and get it ready for this big night. And they got real enthused. I don't know whether somebody had tipped them off that I was going to be leaving, but they got real enthused. And the first thing they said to me was, "Steve, we're really happy that you're going to be the chairman Saturday night." And for the next half hour, I tried to tell them that I wasn't going to be there, that I was leaving to go to Pompano Beach, Florida. But there was no way. So I went back to the store and gave my secretary a letter to Wesley that I couldn't be in Pompano Beach. And as it turned out, it was a great night, and it was the night after my 18th birthday, and I was kind of glad that I stayed back where it was 42 below instead of going down to that hot planet. And I mention gratitude because I'm so grateful for what has happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about the things that have happened to me that Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me get through. And I'm not talking about the easy things, I'm talking about the tough things. And this is what I love so much about Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see some young people here tonight. I came when I was only 27 years of age. I only drank for 11 years. And you know, I used to say to people when they would say something about, "I can't understand this," I used to tell people, and people used to tell me, "Well, you drank for a long time. It's going to take you that long to get better." But I can't tell myself that anymore because I've been sober 18 years and I was only drunk or only drank for 11. I've gone over that. So I should know better. But I guess I'm just a human being. I started drinking when I was only 16. It seems everybody started drinking when I was only 16. I don't know why I started to drink. I came from a real good family. Came from a poor home, but I came from a spiritual home. I was a good athlete. I was a good student. But I didn't like the discipline of my home. I didn't like the discipline of my school. I didn't like the discipline of my church. And I was a real smart guy, and I decided that I would get away from all of this discipline. And I ran into the Army. Now, that's real smart. And if any of you young people tonight are thinking about running away from discipline, well, try running into the Army. And you'll find some discipline, believe me. I mean, that's how smart I was. And I thought I was a real smart guy. I went into the Army, and I started to drink. I didn't see anything wrong with it because everybody was drinking. But I found one thing, that it was the answer to my problem, and it wasn't a problem. It was the answer to my problem. Because I could be what I wanted to be when I drank. I could be anything I wanted to be when I drank. I became one of those people that had a big capacity. I got kicked out of the Army. I went back home, I got a job, and I was glad I got kicked out of the Army because I had been an instructor in the Army and I didn't like the responsibility, but I didn't know it then, but I was glad because I got away from responsibility. And I went back home and I got a good job, and once again I got too much responsibility and I ran back into the Army. And all of the time I was drinking, and I was drinking far too much, but I didn't see anything wrong with it because everybody was drinking, because this is the type of a crowd I associated with. I went back into the Army. I got recommended for my commission. I took officer's training. Thank God for the Canadian Army that I didn't get my commission. I got kicked out of the Army. And I went back to my hometown and I worked for a newspaper. And you must remember, I was only 18 years of age. I was drinking with big people, so I thought. people who are much older than me. And I liked to drink. And I was glad that I got kicked out of the Army because I didn't want the responsibility of a commission in the Army. I worked for this newspaper, and once again I got too much responsibility, and I ran back into the service, but this time into the Navy. I went through officer training in the Navy, and I would like to stand here and say that I was an officer in the Canadian Navy, but I got kicked out of officer's training. I didn't get kicked out of the Navy, I got kicked out of officer's training. And I became a gunner on a merchant ship, and I sailed all over the world. I drank all over the world. And I thought I was one of these guys that was really living. I thought this was the way to live. I was proud of myself because I could drink as much, and if not more, than other people. I was proud of myself for the fact that no matter where we were, that I liked to booze and I could drink it. During my time in the Navy, I got married to a little girl back home, and I led her one hell of a life, both while I was in the Navy and after the war. I went back to my hometown after the war, and I celebrated the end of the war, and I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War. I started to get jobs, and I started to get fired. I lost many jobs. I worked for a jail. I worked for a plumbing and heating shop. I went into business for myself. I got kicked out of the business by my partner. And the same day I got kicked out of the business, my wife took my two little girls and she left me. And I was only 25 years of age. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just went because I knew there was a meeting there and I thought you could walk in and see what it was all about. I didn't know there was something that you had to do. I just went in, and I tell this story because it always scares me when people tell a drunkalogue and they tell of the horrible things. And I've got nothing against you people who maybe have a drunkalogue that's 43 years old. I've got nothing against that. But I can tell you what it almost did to me that night. It almost killed me. Because I was 25 years of age, I had a little bit of money, I was driving an automobile, my home was broken up, I'd lost a business, and I was looking for some answers. And all of the people that spoke that night were older people. And none of them told me how to sober up, but they all told me how to drink. And they all told me what had happened to them. And every one of them said, then I joined Alcoholics Anonymous and everything is all right. But I didn't get that part of their message. What I got was the fact that maybe I had another 15 or 20 years to drink. Thank God I didn't last that long. I only lasted for another 2 years. I went into hospital, and I went into hospital because I had a heart condition. This is what I told the doctor. I'd had scarlet fever and rheumatic fever when I was in the service, and when I went into the hospital, I got 100% pension. So I went into the hospital drunk, beaten up, and I told the doctor I wanted to go in because of my heart. And that way, at least my family would be looked after. Well, you see, after my wife and family had left me for 1 month, I promised my little wife that I wouldn't drink anymore, and I didn't. I didn't drink anymore for 2 weeks. I stayed sober. And then for the next 2 years, I led her just one hell of a life. But when I landed up in hospital, and I hope I never forget it, it was cold back home in Prince Albert. The doctor came to see me. And you know, sometimes I hear members of Alcoholics Anonymous criticize doctors. Well, maybe there are some doctors you can criticize. I don't know. But thank God that this doctor knew what he was doing when he came to see me. Because he said, "Cease, I have done everything I can do for you. as far as building you up physically. He had given me intravenous. And he told me there was nothing more that he could do. And I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And he said, well, as far as I'm concerned, Cease, you're an alcoholic. He had known me when I was in the service. And he didn't mince any words. He didn't protect alcoholism like some people do. He said, you are an alcoholic as far as he was concerned. And the fact that he told me the truth and that he talked to me man to man meant something. And I said, okay, what am I supposed to do? And he said, well, I would suggest that you join Alcoholics Anonymous. But he didn't leave it at that. He didn't wait for me to come out of that hospital to join Alcoholics Anonymous because I probably wouldn't have done it. He went out and brought Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And the two people that he brought to see me, they didn't have to talk because I knew both of them. One of them was the sloppiest drunk in all of Canada. And this night he was sober. He was dressed up. He had a white shirt on. He had a bow tie on. And his suit was pressed and his hair was combed and he was clean. And I knew that something had happened to him. And when they talk about the example of the alcoholic that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, I think this is what they mean. How they look to the suffering alcoholic. And the other guy was a guy that I'd been in the service with. And he'd gone to a penitentiary for 5 years because of robbery with violence when he was drinking. And he found Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary. And this is one reason that I am so grateful to inmates in penitentiaries. And this is one reason that I still am privileged to do a lot of work in institutions. Because he found AA in there and brought it to me in a hospital. And they told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me that it worked, but they didn't have to tell me it worked because I saw it working within them. You know, I can remember getting out of that hospital. I was always a big shot when I was drinking. I was a high-class bum. I was always dressed up. It didn't matter whose money I spent to get the clothes. But I can remember trying to get out of that hospital because I had a bad check down at the office. Because I'd written a bad check to get a private ward. Because I was a big shot. And it seems that little Catholic sister just didn't want to let me out of there until I paid the check. And I phoned my bootlegger. Because my credit was good with him. And he came and got me out of hospital. And lent me the money. And I can remember when I mentioned it's 42 degrees back home when I left home. I can remember that morning getting out of that hospital. And I can remember him driving me down to a cafe. And at that time, there were about 8 people in Alcoholics Anonymous in my hometown. And I wish you could have seen me. I'd been in a fight. I was black and blue all over. I had no buttons on my shirt. It was cold outside. And I went to this little old cafe. And they started to come in. And I hope I never forget that morning. Because that's the morning I came to you people. And they came in and they didn't ask me a bunch of stupid questions. They said, Cease, do you want to stop drinking? And I said, I want to stop drinking. And they took me by the hand and they understood me. And I went home. And they'd been up to see my little wife. And when I got home, I didn't get the usual blast that I usually got when I came off a drunk. She said, I think things are going to be okay. And that night we went to our first meeting. And I hope I never forget that. It was a Saturday night. And I just didn't believe that people didn't drink on Saturday night. Because this was one night that I had to drink. And I went there, and those people were having fun, and they were laughing. And this is why I like the laughter of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for God's sakes, never stop laughing. Because this is what makes it. This is what I saw that night. I saw what I wanted to be, the places that I tried to buy my way into. And I saw these people accept me and laugh and grin as they shook my hand. And they had a little party. And I didn't believe that they were all sober, believe me, because I didn't believe that people could have a deal like that on Saturday night without drinking. I thought that some of them must have been drinking. But I found out that they weren't. And the deal lasted until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And then a couple of them took me aside, and I was a real young guy as far as that group was concerned. And they said, "Cease, there are no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's a meeting at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and you must be there." You know? And I'm glad they talked to me like that. Because I was one of these guys that I needed people to talk to me like that. And it seems the wisdom of Alcoholics Anonymous will come through if you tell people the truth. And this is what they did with me. And I have never missed meetings since that day. I went into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got enthused about it. And maybe it was because I didn't have any other place to go. I don't know. But you see, people weren't exactly knocking my door down and asking me to join other clubs. My name had come up for the Kinsman Club of Prince Albert. Kinsman Club is an all-Canadian organization, similar to Alcoholics Anonymous, the service club. And I'm the only one that I know of that was ever blackballed out of that club because I drank too much. And after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they came and asked me to join the Kinsman Club. And today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of you people, another fellow that's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and in that Kinsman Club, after you're 40 years old, you have to leave the Kinsman Club. But we are the only two honorary members in that club. Which is a real wonderful thing to happen to any man. And it all happened because of you people. And when I talk about gratitude, this is what I feel. Because gratitude is not something that you talk about. Gratitude is something that you do. And so many people go around and say, "I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous." And then ask them to do something. And you'll find out how grateful they are. Thank God I don't see this exist down in this area, but I'm privileged to go to a lot of areas. And I see it. Where people are who are not as enthusiastic as you people. And I can't help but be grateful because of the things that have happened to me. But after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and after the enthusiasm wore off, after the people quit patting me on the back, after my friends quit saying, "Steve, you're doing a wonderful job." I'm talking about the people that weren't in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know how they are. They finally, the old, you get off cloud nine, people quit appreciating you. And you get thinking, well, maybe this thing is not so good. For at that time, you see, back home, all they had was discussion groups. People talked about how much they drank. Then somebody else talked how much they drank a little bit more. And then somebody else, I'm sure, told a few more lies because we all beat each other's story. And we would take step 8, and then we'd take step 1, and then we'd take step 12. And then we'd take step 3. And we really didn't know what we were talking about. But you know, tonight, when Jim read, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has sorely followed our path." And then it says, if you want what we have, here are the steps we took. And I think this is the answer. And have you ever heard people, some new one comes to Alcoholics Anonymous or to Al-Anon or to Alateen, and especially to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they come in and they say to some guy that's been in a long time or some gal that's been in a long time, and they say, how does this thing work? And you hear some old member say, I don't know how it works, but it works. And every meeting we ever go to, we read chapter 5. There's a whole chapter donated to how it works. So it must prove one thing, that we read it a lot, but we don't listen to it a lot. And this is what I'm going to talk about tonight. For you see, when I came to AA, I lost, suddenly had this void after about a year. And every time we got up to about step 3 or to step 4 or something, we got a new member in and we went back to step 1. And suddenly we had a guy by the name of Ernie. And Ernie had a lot of problems with the AA program. He was in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came, and he had a lot of problems. Ernie's not with us anymore. He died a year ago last October, but he died sober. One night he said, if you people want me to chair, and we'd ask him to chair for 3 months, he said, I'm going to chair it, but I'm going to start at step 1, and I don't care if the mayor or if King George or Queen Elizabeth or whoever might come into Alcoholics Anonymous, if they come in, we are not going back to step 1. We are going to keep going. And he said, not only that, you're all going to keep going with me. And he said, if some new one comes, we're going to take them by the hand and we're going to tell them what we're trying to do. And we agreed with him. And we started looking at those steps. And it said, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And I had looked at the part that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that. Everybody else in my hometown knew it. But I had neglected to look at the unmanageability of my life. Not while I was drinking, but while I was sober. I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was still doing haywire things. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous owing $6,200. And $6,200 in 1952 was $6,200, believe me. And I didn't know it for a house or a car or a Chesterfield or some furniture. I just owed it. And my boss one day, thank God I had a good boss, he took me to the bank and he got me off the hook. And he endorsed my notes, and I paid everybody off, and then I just owed the bank. And he made me sign a paper that I would never charge anything again. And about a year and a half later, he took me off the hook again for about $7,000. And I tell that story because I know that a lot of us try to buy our way back into society. We try to buy our families back instead of giving them the love that they want. Why is it that every member of Alcoholics Anonymous wants to be loved, but they don't want to love? They would sooner buy. And this is what I tried to do. And I went into debt again. And if this isn't an unmanageable life, I don't know what is. But I found this out in Alcoholics Anonymous in step 1. After I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous for quite some time. And then in that second step, it just came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. How could I be restored to sanity if I wasn't insane? My idea of an insane person was one that was in a mental hospital. I'd never been there. A power greater than myself, I kind of believed it, but I'd sort of lost faith and I was having a difficult time with it. But thank God somebody took me by the hand and they explained it to me. That these things were happening to me and I wasn't doing too much to make them happen. and they were still happening, so maybe there was something bigger than me looking after me. And then being restored to sanity, they start telling me about some of the insane things that I was still doing. And believe me, they hit me right between the eyes, and I'm glad they did. And I accepted that step too. And then they said, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand it. They threw that word God at me. But I was ready to accept it because somebody had explained it to me. They had taken the time. And this is what I mean about sponsorship. Are we ready to take the time with the new person? Because I don't believe we're having any trouble to get people to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. But I think we're having trouble to keep them there because we are not showing them the way. And I hope I'm talking to the wrong people. But I'm not down here as a member of the Chamber of Commerce. I'm down here because Wesley invited me to be in Atlanta, Georgia, and I didn't know where I was coming. But I love every one of you, and I'm glad I'm here. But if I say something that people say is not right, I'm sorry. But I'm only telling you what I learned out of that book and what I tried, and I know that it works. And I made this decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him for speech. Not as you understand Him for you or as I understand Him for me, but just as I understand Him for me. This is the way it's got to be for me. And then they went on to that fourth step. And it said, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. Not of somebody else, but of myself. Because I was like that Presbyterian minister. I was a gossip. Not only was I a gossip, I maliciously damaged people because of my tongue. Because I wanted to build myself up. But here they tell me that I should take a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And if you go to the 12 by 12, it tells you you should write it down. And this is what I had to do. I'm not saying that you have to do this. I'm telling you this is what I had to do. And the reason I say this is because I went to a lot of people. And I asked them, how about this fourth step? And they said, don't worry about it. And the reason they said that is because they hadn't taken it. How can they possibly tell me how to take it if they haven't done it themselves? And this is what I mean when I say we should be able to direct the people that are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous how to do this program. And I don't care if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, or Alateen. If you haven't taken a four-step, try it tonight. Get a pencil and a paper and start to write. And if there's nothing wrong with you, like there was with me, write that down. Nothing. But then right underneath it, write it down that you're a liar. You know? And you've got to start. And then you can take it from there. And then they came to that beautiful step five. Admitted to God, to myself, and to another human being, the exact nature of my wrong. You know the only thing that's difficult about step five? Is step four. When you take step four the way it's supposed to be taken, I guarantee that you will want to take step five. But how can you possibly go and talk to somebody if you don't know what is wrong with you? And if you take step four properly, you've taken two-thirds of step five. You've admitted to God and to yourself. And then all you have to do is go and talk to somebody else. And you know, when you've done all that, you haven't really done anything. Because step six says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's when we get into the program. Are we ready? We've admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our lives are unmanageable. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We've made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand it. We've made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and we've admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And now, if you look in the 12 by 12, it says step 6 is the step that separates the men from the boys. Are we willing to go out and do this? So some of you might say, what's this got to do with drinking or not drinking? Well, I think that every one of us that come around this program, I think that we're very self-centered people. It tells us this in the book. And it doesn't matter whether if we're in Al-Anon or Alateen. If you've lived around drunks long enough, you have to get that way in order to survive. So you too are self-centered people. And what do these steps do when you take them in sequence? It whittles a little bit off that self-centeredness off, and it whittles us down to size. You know, when I was at the International Conference in Toronto 5 years ago, they asked me to be on the All-Canadian panel. And they asked me to talk on step 6. And I thought, well, why would they ask me to talk on step 6? All of the other steps have got so much depth to them. Why would they ask me to take step 6? But I believe that God works in mysterious ways. Because when I started to study step 6, I found out that I hadn't been willing to have God remove all these defects of character. And I started to study it, and thank God I did. Because I finally started to let go and let God. And then it goes on to that wonderful step 7, where it says, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. It doesn't say we have to pray. They're real smart, those drunks that wrote this program for us. They say, humbly ask him. How can we possibly humbly ask him unless we pray? And that's what they asked me to do in step 7. And I was one of these guys that talked about prayer. And I told people, you know, you can pray driving your car, you can pray riding horseback, riding an airplane, walking down the street. Pray any way you want. But I never, ever told somebody to pray by getting down on their knees. And I wonder why I didn't. Because I hadn't been down there myself. And it's a little difficult to tell somebody to get down on their knees if you haven't been down there yourself. And when Wesley and I were delegates together, we met a guy in New York by the name of Shy. Shy Walker was his name. Shy's not dead. And I can remember dear old Shy telling the story about wearing the high-top boots when he came out of prison and how he couldn't get down on his knees and how he was having a difficult time to stay sober. But how one night, quite by mistake, he kicked his boots underneath the bed. And in the morning when he got up, he had to get down on his knees to get his boots from underneath the bed, so he thought, well, I'll say a few words while I'm down here. And you know, some of you laugh. But those were the greatest words that I'd ever heard, because I found a way to get down on my knees. I didn't have high-top boots, but ordinary shoes worked pretty good. And today, thank God, I don't have to kick the boots under the bed anymore. I can get down. And I can ask him to remove my shortcomings. But then it comes to that step 8, and it said, made a list. We have to make another list of all the people we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And you talk to so many people, and they say, well, I've made a mental list. And I've gone back to the book, and I can't find where it says that. It says, made a list. And I'm sure if any of you gals are going out shopping tomorrow, and if you make a list, you don't make a mental list, you write it down what you want. And why is it when we're playing with the plain old business of everyday living and we're playing with our lives, do we refuse to make a list? But this is what it asks us to do. That's all it asks us to do in step 8. Make a list and become willing to make amends to them all. And you know the tough thing about step 8, as far as I was concerned, was step 9. Because I read step 9 first. And I found out that I had to go out and make direct amends. And so there were a lot of things that I didn't write down. And I wonder why we have to make direct amends. There must be a reason for it. Well, I talked about self-centeredness. And if you want to become just a little bit more humble, and if you want to get some of this self-centeredness whittled off you, tomorrow just try it. Go and say that you're sorry to some person that doesn't even know that you hurt them. And you'll find out how good you really feel. And I believe that that's the purpose of the thing. Where we can get the knots out of our stomach and we can walk around a free person. This is the idea, the object of the exercise, is to do these things. And you know, I told this story probably over in Mount Eagle about the toughest amend that I had to make. And it was a lousy $3 amend. And I told you I owed $6,200. But the $3 amend was one that I had to make because I had been sitting in a beer parlor one time and some guys came in and they asked me to go to a hockey game with them. And I didn't have any money, so they said they'd pay my way in. They asked me to sit in the back with a case of beer, 12 bottles of beer. When we got out of the car, they said, lock the door. Well, they got out, and I didn't lock the door. I lost them in the crowd. I went back and stole the beer. I went down to an Army-Navy club where I used to drink all the time, and somebody stole it from me, and I was going to clean the place out. Bunch of thieves in the town. And then a couple of days later, these fellas said, what happened to your hockey game? And I said, I lost you, big crowd. And they said, do you know that somebody broke into our car and stole our beer? And I said, imagine that, you know? And after I sobered up, every time it seemed that I came around a corner in that small town of mine, I ran into those two guys. And they grinned at me. Finally, one day, one of them came in, he borrowed $10 from me. One night, my wife and I were coming from a show, and I went in to get her a package of cigarettes. And the two of them were there, grinning. He called me over and he said, here's the $10 on you. And I said, how much is a case of beer? And he said, what do you want to know for you to quit drinking? And I said, well, just how much is a case of beer? You know, he didn't make it easy. And finally, I had to say to him, the night that we went to the hockey game, the night that somebody stole your case of beer, I was the guy that stole your case of beer. And then they wouldn't believe me. You know, they didn't make it easy. So I put down $3 and I left. Now you might wonder, well, what's so great about that? I meet them still on the street and I can grin back at them. That's what's so great about it. And I don't care what they're saying about me. And I don't have to dodge them. What was so tough about it? It wasn't the $3. It was admitting that I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and a sponger, and all of it. Once again, it whittled some more of the self-centeredness off me and brought me down to size. That's what it did. And that's why it's so important that I made those amends. And then it came to that wonderful step 10, where we still have to continue to make a personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. And I love to talk about step 10 because I think what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous can happen to many, many people. Well, you see, after being in AA for 10 years, I became a big shot once again. I forgot about what you people were talking about. And I became very interested in material things. And I got some of those material things. But in getting those material things, I became spiritually poor. And I had a real good job. And I thought they couldn't get along without me. But one day they fired me. And this was a blow to my ego. And I remember walking down the street with great resentment in my heart, still very, very self-centered. the fact that they would do this to the great Chief Corbel. And I had a little cousin, and she too is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came to Prince Albert just about this time from the west coast of Canada. And one day I was leaving to go to a roundup with a dear old friend of Wes and I's who passed away last fall, dear old Dave. Dave came to get me because he knew I was in trouble. I hadn't drank, but I was in trouble. And he came to get me to go to this roundup. It was about 400 miles away from where I live. And I had money. I went down, I bought a brand new front. And I went down to see that little cousin. And in my big egotistical way, I stood up in front of her and I said, "Well, kid, how do I look, you know?" And she said just a few simple words, but I hope I never forget them. Because she said, "You look real good on the outside, Cease, but how are you really on the inside?" And I made that trip to Flin Flon, Manitoba. And I took a look at Cease, and I didn't like what I saw. I went into Winnipeg, which is 600 miles away. I was planning what I was going to do with my future. And I spent a couple of days in a hotel room by myself. And I took a look at sea. And I came back to you wonderful people. I never was away in body. I was going to meetings, but I got away from you. I became a big shot. And I forgot what I was and where I'd come from. And that's why I think that step is so important, and that's why I think it's exactly where it is. Because those people that wrote those steps know that we can do this. Because this program was written by drunks for drunks. And then it comes to that wonderful 11th step. Sought through prayer and meditation. To improve our conscious contact with God as we understand it. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. How could we possibly go to step 11 and see the true significance of it and see the meaning of it and see how it can really work if we haven't taken those 10 steps in sequence ahead of it? But today I can sit down and meditate, which is only listening to me. I can pray. And I can accept things like they talk about in the Serenity Prayer. And these things are possible because of those wonderful steps. And then it goes on to that beautiful step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So every one of us, I think, wants things to happen too fast. We come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and 6 weeks later, nothing's happened. We're something like a little drunk. We're sitting in a bar, and his buddy came in, and he said, "What's the matter, Charlie? You look a little down the dumps." Well, he said, 2 months ago, he said, "My uncle died and left me $100,000. Well, he said, "That's too bad." "That's not all," he said. "Last month, my aunt died, and she left me $80,000. So his buddy said, "Well, you know, at least it wasn't a total loss. You've got $180,000. They're probably old people anyway." He said, "So what are you looking to glum for?" He said, "This month, nothing yet." No. And I think that's what we're like. We want everything to happen as we sit there. And I think this is a trait that we all have. But there in that 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. As far as I'm concerned, and as far as I can find out from that book, the 12 by 12 and the big book, that is the only way that it can happen. Some of you might say it was different for Bill. But you must remember that Bill was a little different person. He was the guy that got it rolling. Maybe he had to have it ahead of time. But I think that the only way that I could get it was through these steps. So what is a spiritual awakening? It's just a personality change as far as I'm concerned. It's where I can think positively today. Where I can be grateful for what has happened to me. And I can think of God as a friend. You know, there's a story about the great actor that was asked to say the Lord's Prayer. And he told these people that he would like to say the 23rd Psalm instead. And he went home and he practiced it. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He practiced it on a tape recorder. He practiced it in the front of a mirror. And the Sunday before he was supposed to say it, he went to church. And his minister said the 23rd Psalm. And he said it's the way it's supposed to be said. And when the great night arrived where this actor was supposed to say it, he stood up in front of this great audience and he said it absolutely perfect, the way that a great actor could do. And when he was finished, he got a standing ovation. And he went back up to the microphone and he said, "Look it, folks, I have a friend of mine in the audience. He happens to be my minister. And," he said, "I would like him to come up here and say the 23rd Psalm." And the minister come up and said it the way it's supposed to be said, from the heart, not from the mouth. And when he was finished, there was no standing ovation. There was a lot of tears in a lot of people's eyes. And once again, the great actor went up to the microphone, and he said, "You see, folks, the difference is between the minister and myself is that I know the sheep, but he knows the shepherd." Just think about that. This is what I want to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to keep it simple like that, where I can get to know the shepherd maybe a little better than the sheep. And then it says, "We tried to carry this message to the alcoholic and still suffering." It just says we tried. We can't always be successful, but it says we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic that still suffers. But how many of us, when we have the opportunity to actually go out and save a life, how many of us sometimes neglect to go, or we're too busy? I don't think it happens. I hope it doesn't happen in this area. But I know it happens in some areas, where we forget who we are and what we are and where we came from. And we become judges and we decide that they've tried it before and they won't make it. This happens. You know, there's a story about the young member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've told it many times. I tell it every time I talk. But the young member of Alcoholics Anonymous who was talking to the old member of AA, and he said, "You know, I'm going to quit." And he said, "Well, why are you going to quit?" And he said, "Well, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me there was nothing to do. Told me I didn't have to do anything, just stay sober. Said it wouldn't cost me anything." And he said, "Now they want money for somebody's birthday party. They want money to send off to general service office. They want me to go to penitentiaries and jails and sit in hospitals and go on 12-step calls and do all of these things." And he says, "It's starting to cost me money, a lot of my time." And he said, "I'm getting sick and tired of it and I'm going to quit." And the old member sat there for a little while. And he said, "You know, son, I don't blame you a bit. Because your story reminds me of the story of my life. But," he said, "when my wife and I were very young, we were blessed with a bouncing baby boy. And," he said, "although somebody told us that three could live as cheap as two, the moment that child was born, he started to cost me money. And I resented it. I had to leave my wife in the hospital. I had to take the kid home. I had to hire people to look after the wife. I had to hire people to look after the new baby. Every time I went downtown, they wanted something for the new baby. Finally, he started to walk and he wanted a tricycle. Finally, he went into public school, and tricycle wasn't big enough. He wanted a bicycle. Then he wanted extra money to go away to summer camp and extra money to do this and extra money to do that. And he said, I was like you. I was getting sick and tired of it. Finally, he said he went into high school. Bicycle wasn't good enough. He wanted a motorcycle. Finally, the motorcycle wasn't good enough. He wanted an old car. Extra money to take the girls out. Extra money to go to summer camp for sporting goods. And he said, I was like you. I was getting sick and tired of it. But then he said, in the final year of high school, that boy of ours died. And he hasn't cost us a penny since. I tell that story because I think it's so close to what we're trying to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, where we can forget the very thing that brought us here tonight, the very thing that flew me I don't know how many miles to Atlanta, Georgia today to be with one, you wonderful people. If anybody had told me this 18 years ago today that I would be here tonight yakking to you people, how could I believe it? Because I was a scared little boy, scared to say my name is Cease and I'm an alcoholic. And yet these things have happened. And then it says we tried to practice these principles in all our affairs. What principles are we talking about? We're talking about these principles, the ones that we've learned in these 12 wonderful steps. Where Rod from Hollywood used to talk about, I'm climbing up 12 glorious steps. Rod, who just passed away not too long ago. And he used to talk about these 12 glorious steps where he was climbing up. And he told a poem. He said a poem, and it was so beautiful. And I think this is why we should be so grateful that we have these 12 glorious steps, but how many of us have really taken them? And how many of us want to take them? And yet, how many of us are looking for the answer? And I don't care whether you're an Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous. The answer is here if you want it, because you had Jim come up here and he read it, and it said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And then it says, here are the steps we took. And when people ask me how I got to be the way I want, the way I am today, that's the only answer I can give them. Because there's no way that I could be here tonight where I could come and talk about a power greater than myself, which I choose to call God today, if it wasn't for you wonderful people and if it wasn't for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, when I talk about gratitude, I am so grateful. Because we were at a family breakfast meeting not too long ago in my hometown, and we had all of the kids there. Little kiddies, 2 years old, 3 years old, 5 years old, and I love kids. And the guy got up to talk, and he said, you know, it's so nice to have the kids here this morning. Because he said, who knows? Someday, maybe some of these kids will become alcoholics. And let's hope that we'll still be around to look after them if they do. But he wasn't serious. He sort of said it as a joke. He didn't mean to, but it just came up. And everybody laughed. And they asked me to speak. And I said, you know what Lenny just said is not so funny. Because I said, I can remember when I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I first came, and there was a little gal sitting there, and she was 8 years old. And I can remember somebody making the same statement. And I can remember how I sort of laughed, because I didn't think it was possible. But I said, that little gal is in the room this morning, and she's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know this story very well, folks, because that little gal is my daughter. And she, too, is a member of us. But thank God I was there when she decided that she needed me. And this is why I can talk about gratitude. Because I know what it means to have one of my own family come and ask me for help. And it wasn't easy for this little gal to ask me for help, because she was only 23 years old when she came. And she was my daughter, and the people that I associate with didn't realize that she drank. And she was afraid to come to AA because she was afraid that maybe she wouldn't be accepted as an alcoholic. Wesley knows this little gal, and she's doing real well in AA. I'm also pleased to say that my wife is a member of Al-Anon, and my other daughter was a member of Alateen before she moved away. And so when I mention gratitude, I'm probably the most grateful guy in this room tonight, because I know what Alcoholics Anonymous can do to a family, because alcoholism is a family illness. And we talk about it being a family illness, and then sometimes we forget. But thank God, it hasn't allowed me to forget, because one of my family was afflicted with the same thing as me. And I only hope that every one of you in the audience tonight think about that. Because maybe someday, somebody in your family will want this wonderful program. And that's what I meant when I talked about the little boy. And the little boy died. Just outside of Omaha, Nebraska, folks, there's a little place called Boys Town. As you drive up to this little town, you see a statue, one little boy with another little boy in his arms. And you can tell by the way that he is bent over, by the sweat on his brow, and by the way that he's trudging through the deep snow, that he's having a very difficult time. But underneath are simple words, something like this. No, Lord, he is not heavy, for he is my brother. Thanks to all you wonderful people in the South for being my brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Cease, for being here with us, and we love you very much. I don't know, I used to say this didn't happen to me, but it happened to me in Mount Eagle, and it happened here again tonight. But thank you for being here with us. We've got our other friend from South Florida that I think we should give him not equal time, but let's call on Wesley P. from Pompano.
Hi, everybody. This is going to be short and sweet. I don't want to take away from that talk because it was tremendous. I want to bring you greetings from South Florida, all Florida, from the state of Florida, and let you know that the 1970 convention is in full swing. We're certainly getting ready to host each and every one of you. How many of y'all coming to the Florida, the 1970 International Convention? Well, we're going to certainly, nice, that's wonderful. We're certainly going to have a party there. We're expecting around 20,000. And everything's getting shaped up for it. It will be July the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of 1970. And we have 53 hotels on Miami Beach being used for the convention. We have every facility that you could think to handle such a crowd as we expect at this convention. On Thursday evening, that's July the 2nd, we will start the convention off with a Get Acquainted dance by a renowned orchestra. And we will close it on Sunday night with a two-hour big entertainment program with Jack Bailey as master of ceremony. Anita Bryant, is that her name? The Florida orange juice girl will be our featured singer. And many more to fill out 2 hours of full entertainment. Of course, every night we will hear from our founder, co-founder Bill Wilson. Al-Anon will have a complete setup over in the Eden Rock with Alateen. So that will be a complete weekend of AA and in every fashion meetings around the clock. And we're certainly looking forward to having each and every one of you there. It's only about a 9-hour drive to get on I-75. You can be there just in 7-8 hours without any trouble. I mean, yeah, you can if you drive fast enough. How far is it? 10 hours? Virgil, how long does it take? About 10 hours is all it is. Don't stop too often. So we are looking forward to having you. And Cece, I want to thank you. You know, I want to tell you about Cece and I. We lived in such opposite environments. I'm an alcoholic from South Florida, and he's an alcoholic from Eskimo land. If it gets 45 degrees where I come from, the world's going to go to pieces, and if it ceases, nothing to have 45 below. So we live from two extremes. I drank alcohol to keep cool, and he drank it to keep hot. But it ended in the same result. We both became alcoholics. And we are the truest of friends and have been for 10 or 12 years. And it's only through Alcoholics Anonymous that we met. And I've been in his hometown. I know what a tremendous job he does in Prince Albert. I've been in all of the prisons he's talked about. And I know all of his sponsor. I know his group. And I know what a great bunch of AAs they are. And I'm quite sure as long as we have AA members like Cece around, well, AA will live forever. Thank you.
Thank you, Wesley. And I hope that a good many more hands will go up before that July the 2nd rolls around than it went up a little bit ago, although that was a good representative number. I've been out of town for the last couple of weeks myself. I don't know of any particular announcements, but while I do get the announcements, make the announcement, I'm going to start the Bastion Bubble. Would you get this one started somewhere? Get to have this turnout tonight, and as I said, stay with us for fellowship and refreshments, and I say again, thanks, Cece and Wesley, for being with us tonight. I'm glad we could all be together. So let us all stand and join hands, and let's close this meeting by praying together the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.